Court is ready to hear argument in 080421, State of Texas versus the Public Utility Commission of Texas.
May it please the Court, Mr. Phillips and Mr. Coleman will present argument for petitioners CenterPoint Energy, Houston Electric, and Texas Genco. Petitioners have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Phillips will open with the first 15 minutes.
May it please this honorable Court. In restructuring the electric industry in Texas, the legislature required the old integrated utilities to break into at least three new entities: a power generation company, a transmission and distribution utility, and a retail electric provider. One of the final steps in this multi-year process were special proceedings known as true-ups, which were conducted by the PUC in 2004. In this case, CenterPoint complains of four errors that we believe have been made in these true-ups. If you'll turn to tab 2 of our bench book with the blue cover, see the four complaints we have here. The first two relate to the stranded cost true-up. That's the excess mitigation credits and the partial stock valuation method. And I will address these two errors. The second two relate to the capacity auction true-up, and Mr. Coleman will address those. The opinion below, while beautifully written, is premised on some flawed assumptions about economics and market operations. Moreover, on several occasions, the Court construed the law to make CenterPoint's compliance with the true-up requirements dependent not on anything CenterPoint did or could do, but on the behavior of persons beyond its control. Let me turn now to the first error I want to complain about, which is excess mitigation credits. In 2001, the PUC ordered CenterPoint to pay refund to the retail electric providers on the mistaken belief that CenterPoint had over-mitigated its stranded costs and was not going to have any stranded costs at the time of the true-up. At that time, Justice Hagton, now Chief Justice Jefferson, recognized that these EMCs were improvident and they would have granted a mandamus to stop them. Since then, the courts have declared EMCs illegal. At the true-up, when it was apparent that CenterPoint did have substantial stranded costs, the PUC recognized its mistake and ordered that these EMCs be paid back to CenterPoint. That order was affirmed by Judge Dietz. The Court of Appeals reversed in part based on a legal mistake that CenterPoint and Reliant, its affiliated retail electric provider, were, quote, a single unit, unquote, for stranded cost recovery. This error came about from a misunderstanding of PURA's sensible requirement that all three of the new unbundled companies file a single true-up application. Each company had certain rights and certain obligations under the true-ups. For instance, the generation company had environmental obligations, the retail provider might have owed a retail clawback, but nothing in the statute suggests that these applicants, which at least in CenterPoint's case were Reliant and CenterPoint were completely separate companies by the time of the true-up, were fungible when it came to awarding stranded costs.
But at a point when you could have negotiated with Reliant what to do about these excess mitigation credits if they should ever have to be refunded, you were in a position to control, to negotiate that with Reliant. And well, you knew, at least you'd taken the position, that these were illegal.
The EMCs were ordered in 2001 to be paid starting January 1, 2002. After May of 2001, CenterPoint and Reliant separated, and Reliant had 20% public shareholders. CenterPoint owned 80%. At that point, because of the fiduciary duty to minority shareholders, CenterPoint could have not come in and said, well, the government's awarded you hundreds of millions of dollars, why don't you just give them back to us?
But you could have negotiated it out. You could have said, we take the position, we don't owe these, but we're going to have to give them to you anyway. We've given up the legal fight. The PUC says they're going to make it all right someday, but just in case, let's have a deal.
Well, it was not our, we did not do it, and I don't think it was our thinking that officers of Reliant would be in very good shape if they went and told their shareholders, the government may have given our company a bunch of money, but maybe that's going to turn out to be the wrong thing, so we've just made a deal to give it back. We did not do that, and we believe it's within the PUC's discretion. If it made an unwise and, as it turned out, illegal order to undo that mistake. If Reliant and CenterPoint were really the same company, then the PUC would not have ordered CenterPoint to pay EMCs to Reliant as well as to the new entrants in the retail market in the first place. And such payments would not have increased CenterPoint's net book value. And that was their whole purpose, was to get the net book value higher so that there would not be as the net book value would be closer to what the PUC thought the market value was going to be. That's a little clearer if you look at tab 3.
Were unaffiliated retailers required to pass the EMCs on to customers?
No, they were not, and there's nothing in the record about the extent to which they did. It's one of the economic mistakes that the Court of Appeals made. They thought that the 40% of the EMCs that did not go to Reliant, that went to the new entrants, were somehow passed on to their customers, and we just don't know that. Similarly, on the payback, as the EMCs are reversed and come back to CenterPoint, we don't know if competition will allow some or all of those to be charged to the customers either. All we know for sure is that under this order, the retail electric providers got 100% of the EMCs, and now they'll have to pay 40% of them back. And as a group, they get to keep 60% of these EMCs.
Can I shift your focus away from the EMC issue to the other sort of stranded cost issue of how to quantify the value of generation assets?
Absolutely. Let's turn to tab 15, please. The PURA gave CenterPoint and all the utilities four choices of how to value the market value of their generation assets. And it was up to the utility to choose which one. And CenterPoint chose this partial stock valuation method, which says that at least 19% but less than 51% of the common stock of a company that owns the generation assets is spun off and sold to public investors through a national stock exchange and trades for at least a year. CenterPoint met each of those requirements as a matter of law. It spun off its generation assets into a new company, Texas Genco. It created that new company. It then spun off 19.04% of the shares of that company, which was over 15 million shares, to its shareholders. It then ensured that an active, transparent market for this stock was made on the New York Stock Exchange, where nearly 38 million shares sold in 14 months of trading. The PUC held that the literal requirements of this language had not been satisfied because 19% of the stock was not both spun off and 19% of the stock, individual shares, were not sold on the market. The problem with this reading is that it makes it impossible for a utility to ensure that it has complied with the PSV method.
Well, the Court of Appeals said not impossible. It said that you could have spun off more. You could have spun off 50%, and in that event, more likely 19% would have been sold.
And that's the key word, more likely. The Court of Appeals language on page 22 was attempt to ensure compliance. You can't be sure. There's two problems. One, you can't be sure. No matter what, if you spin off 50%, you can't be sure that at least 19% of those individual shares will sell. This was, after all, a very rapidly rising stock.
So what does selling through a national stock exchange mean, then? I mean, you don't have to make sure it happens.
It means listed on one of two stock markets. Mm-hmm. It means listed on the New York Stock Exchange, which has minimum requirements for number of shareholders, number of shares, and volume. It requires $100,000 a month.
So you say sold means listed?
It cannot mean that. Yes.
I know they were out there for a year. Do you know what percentage was actually sold, traded on that market?
Well, we know that the average share changed hands 2.5 times. We don't know each individual share, and indeed you can't know each individual share, because when the brokers hold stock, All CenterPoint can do is go ask the brokers for information about which particular shares have sold, and the brokers have to talk to the owners of the individual stock, who under SEC rules can keep that information private if they want to. So there's truly no way either the PUC or CenterPoint could have complied with finding out if 19% had sold.
The CA noted, in their opinion, that you could have complied by conducting an IPO, that instead of a dividend distribution, you know, giving away shares to existing shareholders, you could have conducted an IPO, and that would have been a bona fide.
And that's totally wrong. If you'll turn to tab 6, IPO, in fact, is even worse than a spinoff, because first you have a private sale of the stock to underwriters. Then the underwriters make a book of bids by other private contracts with investors. And only after you've reached a certain level of success can you certify to the New York Stock Exchange to get it listed. None of the purchases from the underwriters are on the exchange. You go out and you have, again, private investors own the stock, and they can hold it or they can sell it. And as you can see from tab 7, this stock was going up very rapidly. There's a lot of good reasons people would not want to sell this stock and take a big short-term capital gain. In essence, the Court of Appeals ignores the traded on a public exchange requirement, which in fact is what gives you a transparent, active market so that you can actually value the stock.
Well, the Court of Appeals seemed concerned that your argument could lead logically to just one share being sold and that would set a value.
Well, they ignore the fact that the New York Stock Exchange says if you don't sell 100,000 shares each and every month, you get delisted. The way it was set up, if you're trading on a national exchange, it cannot be a failed stock. You can have a failed IPO. You can have failed stocks, but not and stay listed on the exchange. So you're guaranteed in that process that a market is made.
But the Court of Appeals seemed to go with a plain meaning approach, that it was up to the legislature to set how much needed to be sold, and that they intended, rightly or wrongly, or misinformed or misguided, but they set 19% as a minimum trade volume.
And that's why I said that the opinion is flawed by economic misassumptions. If you'll turn to the last tab.
Well, isn't that also an argument that the statute is flawed by economic assumptions?
No.
That mean we take another look at maybe what language should be in the statute rather than applying what's in it?
If the legislature had said clearly this, you got to make sure each share sold, yes, that would be right. But they didn't. This language is susceptible of several interpretations. Government Code Section 311.021, which is on tab 17, said that in construing statutes, you are to presume that a result feasible of execution is intended. And that's what you can't do with the Court of Appeals interpretation.
Well, but what are the parameters of feasibility of execution? Because the Court of Appeals seemed to say that spent on 50%, you're going to get 19% of sales. It's maybe not very practical. It's maybe not very probable, but it's feasible. How much leeway do we give the legislature here?
Well, this sentence can be read several ways. You could read it to say that however many shares you spin off, each and every one of those has to sell. If you spin off 40 million shares and 39,990,000 sells, you fail. That can't be right, and nobody advocates it. You can also read that you spin off 19% and then the shares are sold on a national exchange for a year. And that's a reasonable reading. The intent of these true-ups was not to play some game. It's not like let's make a deal and there's doors and some of them get a prize and some you don't. And it's not like a rate case where the PUC has great discretion to, you know, come up with a fair answer. So the one time, one shot deal. And
well, if it's not a game, why not go with the asset sale contract?
Well, why would the legislature?
As your CEO sort of said, he thought was a fair thing when he testified.
Well, we don't believe the legislature gave four choices, and two of them were bad, that two of them were trash cans or lumps of coal behind the door. We believe that it should be interpreted where each one of the four options they gave can be complied with certainty so that you will know the exact answer of your stranded costs and what you're entitled to in
Counsel,
the true-up.
Then your argument would, looking at 39.262H3, mean that if more than 51% of stock were traded, then you could still find a way to comply with the statute, even though the statute says between 19 and 51.
Well, my argument is, let's suppose you choose to go with the stock valuation method, and that is give up control of this company, spin off and sell more than 50% of it. You can't be sure you complied with that, because you don't know that 50% will actually sell, and that's absolutely stupid. I mean, what the legislature wanted was for you to no longer have control of the company, and it doesn't matter whether those shareholders sold it once or not.
For centuries, we've been trying to figure out what the legislature wanted, as we are here. But it says 19 to 51. Numbers are numbers.
And they do have to be spun off. If we had spun off 18.99%, we wouldn't be here. But we spun off enough that the legislature thought, and rightly so, that they could make an accurate market for this stock. And we certainly did. It was the 15th best performing stock of the top 1,000 stocks in America.
Was the sale of assets method feasible or not feasible?
Well, it was feasible and eventually was done. But I just can't believe that we would interpret this statute to say there's some gotchas in here. There are methods that are written up, and we're going to diagram the sentence so that you can't be sure you've complied with it. The 19% was a very sensible rule. If you own more than 80% of the company, you can file consolidated tax returns, which can be a substantial savings to a multi-layered corporate entity. It's in there for a reason. And the Court of Appeals rationale that clearly the legislature didn't want you to be able to do that, and even if you did, it might or might not succeed, I think defies common sense. It's unreasonable. The PUC's interpretation is entitled to no deference. Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. As with its stock valuation analysis, the PUC improperly disregarded legislative dictate and carefully considered policy choices in misinterpreting and misapplying the capacity auction true-up. I'd like to list out and then explain four primary reasons why we believe the PUC and the Third Court erred. First, the legislature expressly required the PUC to use the prices obtained in the PUC-led transparent public market that was the capacity auctions in calculating the amount of the true-up. Nothing in the legislative text, its structure, or the legislative objectives conditioned true-up eligibility on the non-affiliated retailers purchasing the full 15% of capacity auction or some set lesser amount. Third, the PUC's interpretation irrationally makes compliance uncontrollable because this was an auction and we could not force people to buy what we brought to the auction to sell. And fourth, the remedy that the PUC ultimately chose, which was grafting in private market sales to the affiliated retailer, was the one thing that the legislature expressly forbade in connection with the capacity auction true-ups. The capacity auctions had a very distinct purpose. They were set up because the legislature knew that new entrants were coming in. They were going to compete with the old monopoly retailers who were being spun off, and in this case, Reliant. They needed access to capacity. So as they're going out building a client base, building a customer base, they had to have electricity. These capacity auctions were set up to guarantee that these new reps would have access to that power. Now, on day one, there wasn't an expectation that these entities would already have 15% of the market. They would just be starting on January 1st, 2002. Nobody could have expected that they were going to, on day one, go in and take 15% of all the electricity. But we had to bring it to market so it would be there for them. This was a market that worked. Every retailer who wanted electricity for these new customers was able to go to the public markets and take it. There's no evidence of any retailer ever saying, I can't secure the electricity that I need for the customers that I have brought on board. These markets worked. Billions of dollars of electricity were sold in connection with the public markets, the capacity auctions. It's not reasonable to say that at the end of the day, we don't think you sold enough. You sold everything that anybody wanted, but you didn't sell enough, and therefore you're not eligible for the true-up.
But the argument is that the formula is wrong, and you say, well, you should have complained about that when the rule was drawn, and maybe so. But if it is wrong, and if it were corrected so that revenues and fuel costs were matched, would you get some result like the PUC came up with or not?
Let me address it this way, Justice Heck. The formula is not wrong. There's not a mismatch of sales and fuel costs. The fuel costs are the fuel that was used and for power that was actually sold. There's not a mismatch. They're unhappy that the prices from the private auctions ended up being somewhat higher than those in the public auction, and therefore you can get a lower number. Their complaint is really that if you use a different formula, you come out with a lower number, and we like a lower number. But the formula is based on a statute that says you must use the prices obtained in this auction and only in this auction. And neither the PUC nor anybody else had authority to come in and say, well, we're unhappy with the way the formula worked out, and therefore we are simply going to disregard what the legislature told us, and on the back end, we're going to Monday morning quarterback it and say, we're going to come up with a different formula, one that the legislature didn't tell us to enact, and come out with a different result because it comes to a different number. I'd like to very briefly touch on the depreciation point. The statute says that we get all of our stranded costs. That's 39252A. That means, under the statute, 39201, which this court addressed in the CenterPoint 1 case 5 years ago, and 39251.7, also addressed in that case, said that stranded costs are determined as of December 31st, 2001, not December 31st, 2003, or some date in 2004. That is the date. What the PUC did here and what the interveners are arguing is the same argument that this court considered and rejected in CenterPoint 1, which is we don't like the way the stranded costs recovery works and the capacity auction works, and therefore we want you to adopt effectively a different date for determining net book value and therefore stranded costs. There is no authority in the statute to do that. The statute in two separate places and several places in the rules says December 31st, 2001. If you would turn just very briefly to tab 11, the point of stranded costs was to say as of December 31st, 01, we're going to give you the difference between your net book value and your market value. In other words, we want to treat you as a hypothetical new market entrant. If somebody came in and bought $2 billion worth of assets on December 31st, 01 and started generating power and selling it, right? We want to treat you like that entity, in parity with that entity. Well, if somebody had come in and bought those assets on December 31st, 01, they started to operate, any depreciation they would have taken would have come off that market value. They would have depreciated below the line, if you will. What the PUC has done is said, we are going to ratchet you up and so that you're not going to be allowed to come down to this market value because we don't want you to take this depreciation off of what would have been the market value line. We want you to take it out of stranded costs. But that's exactly what the legislature forbade. It's not incumbent and not appropriate for the PUC to say, we reject what the legislature put into the statute, we're going to come up with a different number and a different method of looking at this than what the legislature allows to arrive at a number that we like better. I see I've got over my time, unless there are questions, I'll reserve
for. Are there any questions? Thank you, Mr. Coleman. We have several people arguing today, but according to my notes, Mr. Day is next for Texas Industrial Consumers.
May it please the court, Mr. Day and Mr. Hall will present argument for the joint petitioners. Joint petitioners have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Day will open with the first 15 minutes.
May it please the court, I'm Jonathan Day. Our firm represents the Texas Industrial Energy Consumer, sometimes known as TIEC. First, a little bit about who's in our group. We are largely composed of ship channel industries like ExxonMobil and Occidental Chemical, but we also include other manufacturers like Texas Instruments. In this case, our firm also represents major hospital systems and private colleges and universities. The cost of electricity, including stranded cost recovery, has an important effect on the prices of the products and services that are provided by these companies. As the court is aware, the customer groups have joined in filing briefs in this case, and we are also consolidating our oral argument. Accordingly, the Attorney General, who represents state institutions who are ratepayers in the Houston area, is also joined in this submission. The institutions it represents are MD Anderson, the University of Houston, and other such institutions. In addition, there are two groups of cities involving more than 30 separate municipalities. So the court should be aware that all ratepayers, large and small, private and public, industrial, residential, commercial, we are all joined in a common position in this case. When the legislature enacted Senate Bill 7, it explicitly set out two fundamental objectives. First, utilities are entitled to recover their stranded costs. But secondly, and explicitly in the statute, stranded costs are not to be over-recovered. These twin legislative objectives set up a fair balance between the interests of the utilities and the ratepayers. Stranded costs are, in fact, an entitlement for the utilities, and ratepayers do not contend otherwise, but those stranded costs are not to be over-recovered. Ratepayers respectfully submit that all four of the claims made by the utility in this case, this court has been asked to directly violate the second legislative mandate, which prohibits an over-recovery of stranded costs. First, regarding market value, the utility is asking the court to ignore the arm's-length sale of its generation assets. The price of this transaction was $253 million more than the amount based on the subjective estimate by a group of investment bankers.
Let me ask you in that connection, if there were 19, if they met the partial stock value component of the statutory paragraph, could the utility choose between that valuation method and the actual sale of the assets?
Your Honor, if they had met the standard, then I suspect, at least in this respect, we wouldn't be here on this point because they would have complied.
Well, what I'm getting at is, if they complied with that and it was a much higher number and they actually sold the assets and it closed before the true-up was over, and that was a much lower number, would they be entitled to the higher number?
You know, I think that, in other words, I think you're asking, suppose the tables were reversed.
Well, you said they're not supposed to over-recover, and the CEO seemed to say the same thing, but does the statute allow them to over-recover in that instance?
No, Your Honor, I don't think so. I think in this circumstance, if we were presented with a situation which was quite unexpected and developed only in the course of the hearing, I don't think they're entitled to over-recover their stranded costs. That what was set out by the legislature was the objective that they would get their full net book value. And it's important, as you have already referred to, the CEO, David McClanahan, of this company said this, and it's in the record, and it's attached to our brief. Was this result the intention of the legislature? You know, I don't think so. They didn't want anybody to have a windfall. And I don't want our company to have a windfall. We are just trying to recover our book value. That's the statement of their own CEO.
The statute says the affiliated power generation company shall quantify its stranded costs using one or more of the following methods. But it's just not clear to me whether it gets to pick or whether if two or more of the provisions applied, the PUC could hold them to the lesser.
I think the PUC in this case is entitled to effect the legislative intent, which is what they get is their net book value, not a penny more. And that's what should have happened in this case. And inexplicably, at least from ratepayers' perspective, that's not what happened. The company has been allowed to over-recover. And if the tables had been turned, let's assume for a moment that what had happened was that the utility had failed in its methodology, and there'd been a sale, but the commission determined by some sort of subjective analysis. The legislature intended here to avoid the use of subjective analyses where competing experts tweak their discounted cash flow models and they come up with a different number. And if there had been a gap there, the utility would surely be here saying we should get our full net book value. We don't object to that. That's what they're entitled to. That's what their CEO says they're entitled to.
The sale of assets method, is there or isn't there a deadline by which that sale has to be completed?
The deadline is specified in the statute, which is that it has to occur after December 31 of 1999. We clearly meet
anything after that is fair game.
Well, honestly, if the true-up hearing had closed and there had not been a transaction, then I think the game is over. But in this particular case, for various circumstances, the utility felt compelled to go forward with this sale of assets, and it was announced. The document is in the record. The bidding process is in the record. There is no, there's not a scintilla of evidence on the part of any party to this case that there was anything defective about the process, the bidding process, or the agreement. There's no challenge to that. We stipulate.
Clarify this. Was the sale finalized at that price sort of set forth in the agreement?
Yes, it was. It was. Now, it was not finalized. It was finalized in two separate closings. One was in December before the commission lost jurisdiction of this matter, and the second one, relating to its nuclear assets, closed in April. But the test here is not whether there's been a passing of the title of the stock. The test is whether have all the terms have been agreed. They were agreed. The Texas cases clearly say that a sale, there is a sale, the asset has been sold when all the terms and conditions have been agreed.
Agreement is sort of the end point and not so much final or formal execution or every I dotted, every T crossed.
Well, in this case, every I was dotted, every T was crossed. The only thing, there were a whole series of regulatory approvals, SEC approvals, Nuclear Regulatory Commission approvals that had to occur before this transfer could occur. Those were all traditional, natural conditions. But all the terms and agreements of the agreement were specified and were ultimately carried out. There was no variation. And no one contests that. We stipulate that this was a sale of assets that qualified under the statute.
Is it possible to prove with certainty compliance with the partial stock valuation method, the percentages?
We disagree. The analysis that's given, for example, that Judge Phillips gave in connection with an initial public offering, we think that that could have been structured in a way that the underwriters would have had to carry forward and the criteria could have been met. What they offer is an post facto explanation, and they say, well, we just couldn't do it. We don't agree with that at all. We think that there were ways that it could have been accomplished. That's their burden. We think the legislature specified, and as the Court of Appeals held, that the interpretation is that a certain number of shares had to be traded, and it needed to meet the 19%, and they didn't meet it.
But the only two, am I wrong that the only two alternative methods suggested are an IPO and spinning off more shares?
Those are the only two suggestions that we had.
Right.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's the only two the Court of Appeals had. Are you going to talk about excess mitigation credits?
Mr. Hall is going to address that if you don't mind, Your Honor.
That's fine.
I will talk briefly about the capacity auction true-up, because it's a very complicated matter, and I appreciate there are issues that are pertinent to that. The important thing about this is to begin with what was the objective of the capacity auction true-up. This court held in the CenterPoint opinion that the capacity auction true-up guarantees consumers and power companies that the power company will receive no more and no less than a margin previously predicted by the ECOM model.
This is because this is to compensate the company for having to make available capacity to the startups.
It was essentially, I mean, they remained in a guaranteed return regime for 2 years. They had an absolute guarantee of the margin that was predicted by the ECOM model. And as the court has already indicated, the formula didn't work. And we were aware of that. The problem was that they didn't sell all the products, so that the 15% was not a representative proxy for what the overall sales for that period were. Now, there is no question they didn't meet the safe harbor requirements of the rule.
Now, could they have just sold it to, like me, the last 21 units or however many were necessary to meet the safe harbor provision? Could they just have sold it to John Doe for $5,000?
Well, I mean, I don't think an artificial or a sale that was not in the ordinary course in the power market wouldn't qualify. I mean, I think that would be a charade. But the capacity auction true-up, what the company essentially argues is there is no relationship between the margin that they in fact earned during that 2 year period and what actually happened under this formula. The formula overcompensated them because it grossly overstated the fuel cost. And it was unrepresentative. And they just basically say, well, look, we got close to implementing the formula, and therefore we ought to get it. That doesn't have anything to do with the objective of the capacity auction true-up, which was to put them in a position where they earned what the ECOM model predicted. What the commission did was entirely reasonable, and they basically looked at all the auctions and they made sure that the margin was accurately portrayed in terms of the actual sales that were made. So our argument here is they didn't meet the test. I mean, there's no question about that. They say, well, we got awfully close. They ignore the fact that there wasn't any safe harbor provision in 2002 with which they could have complied. And they also ignore, they just step away from the proposition that this commission has declared it would be inequitable. It would be a windfall for this company to get the additional $440 million. It would simply be an unfair result. Close, in terms of compliance with the safe harbor rule, doesn't count when the threshold for minimum compliance has been set at an extremely low level and the result of noncompliance has been determined by the commission to be an inequitable windfall. One more comment with regard to depreciation. This court held in the CenterPoint opinion that the results of the capacity auction true-up should be taken into account in determining whether there has been an over-recovery of stranded costs. That's explicit language. It says there's a relationship between stranded costs and the capacity auction true-up. This was a time period when the company had essentially a guaranteed return, and it was entirely appropriate to reduce the stranded cost award by the depreciation cost during that time period. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you, Councilor.
May it please the court. My name is Alton Hall, and I represent the City of Houston and the Coalition of Cities. The issue I will be addressing is the excess mitigation credit. Contrary to the assertions by CenterPoint in its brief and by Justice Phillips, the issue before this court is whether or not CenterPoint is permitted under the Public Utility Regulatory Act to recover twice from ratepayers, specifically price.
I don't understand that. It just seems to me like whether they should have to pay once. I don't get the double dip argument.
I'll be happy to address that just a sec. Essentially, what you have to understand is that what happened is customers, including price to beat customers, which are primarily, in large part, low-income customers, paid for years rates that ultimately ended up being higher than the approved return. That's what resulted in the excess earnings. In a normal circumstance, those excess earnings would have been returned to ratepayers, either through a credit or a refund of some sort. During the time period that we're talking about, this 2000-2001 time period, well, actually started in the late 90s, the commission said, well, since we're looking at going to deregulation, you may have positive stranded costs. Everything was based essentially off a report to the legislature back in, I believe it was 1998-99 timeframe.
But it was wrong.
That's correct.
So the customers didn't pay. They underpaid.
The customers did pay. What happened is the customers, they got these excess earnings. CenterPoint used those excess earnings to mitigate its stranded costs to the tune of about $1.2 to $1.5 billion. They did get that money, and they did use it to offset the anticipated stranded costs. So that was the first time, because as I said, were it not for the commission allowing them to retain those funds for mitigation purposes, they would have been returned to ratepayers, but they were not. So that's the first time.
Let me ask you, is it true that, as I asked petitioner, that the unaffiliated retailers were not required to pass on the EMCs to their customers?
There was not a specific requirement in order, but it was certainly anticipated that they would, and that was the purpose of giving it to the unaffiliated retail electric providers, just like the affiliate.
They'd only do it if they needed it to compete, I guess.
That's absolutely right, and the expectation was that they would do it in order to compete.
But no studies or information show whether they did or they didn't.
There's no study that I'm aware of in the record.
Since we don't know whether they did or they didn't, why should we treat Reliant differently from the ones that we don't know what they did?
Because with Reliant, we do know. And with Reliant, we know with absolute certainty that those funds that were paid to Reliant, we know the exact amount, $385 million, were not passed through to price to beat customers. They were forbade from doing that by the commission as it read the price to beat statutes and regulations, which they interpreted as forbidding them from changing that price. So we know with absolute certainty what happened with those funds. That's the reason why when CenterPoint came in, it actually addressed that specifically and said we're entitled to that money along with the rest. The commission looked at that issue specifically because we knew with certainty there. And we knew for a fact that customers in that situation never got the credit. And that's why we're here, because we took the position at the commission, and ultimately the Court of Appeals looked at the issue and agreed with us that it would be a double recovery and, in fact, an over-recovery under Section 39.262A to allow CenterPoint to recover those same funds again from those same customers. Because one thing you have to understand is once you get to the second stage, there's no question that the ratepayers are going to pay because it goes into non-bypassable charges. And so it's going straight to the customers. It's not like it's going just to Reliant, and Reliant can say, well, we won't pass it through. In that instance, it's going to be passed through.
If the PUC had not required EMCs, we wouldn't be worrying about this today.
If the PUC had not required, that's correct.
So they made a mistake, and now the question is CenterPoint going to pay for it, or are the customers going to pay for it?
That's one way to look at it, and I think if you look at it in that way, you still come to the same result because of several reasons. One, the question is, who was in the best position to have anticipated and addressed this issue? The price to beat customers who have no control, no ability to address this issue or address this situation, or CenterPoint, who has made several arguments for why it should not be in this position, one of which is we're separate companies. Well, 262A doesn't make a distinction. It says you look at them together in determining whether or not the over-recovery. And it specifically references the affiliated retail electric provider. It does not say only if they're one company. CenterPoint chose to separate in the way that it did. It wasn't required by the statute. Secondly, the point that you raised with Mr. Phillips, they knew at the time they were separating that EMCs or some other mechanism would be used to return these excess earnings that they had used to mitigate. They knew that because there was an order that came out on certified questions well before their business separation plan and their final separation was approved. They could have negotiated with Reliant, which at that point was still part of CenterPoint, a way to get this money back from Reliant. They didn't. So essentially what you're being asked to do is approve a circumstance where CenterPoint is requesting where they took money from one hand, put it in another hand, and now they're asking the ratepayers who paid the first time they had it in the hand to pay again for this empty hand. That is a violation of Section 39.262A, but equally as important, I believe that's bad public policy. In these economic times, to require these low-income ratepayers who have the least ability to affect this circumstance, the least ability to bear the burden of what Justice Heck called a mistake, is just wrong.
Well, counsel, if you assume the EMCs are a mistake, then either CenterPoint pays or the customers pay. You said that's one way to look at it. What's your other way to look at it?
Well, I think one way to look at it is that you could simply look and say that you act as though the EMCs were never there and you just don't put them in stranded costs. And I guess, in essence, you're going back to CenterPoint paying. But I guess I was referring more to the question of, was it a mistake? I don't know that you could say it was a mistake. It was the circumstances that were before the commission at the time. I think that they acted based upon the way they interpreted the statute and the circumstances at the time. So that's what I was referring to more so than other options.
Some of us thought it was a mistake.
I understand that, Justice Heck.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Hall. The court is now ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Ms. Sterling will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. Although the commission asked this court to affirm the Court of Appeals opinion in all respects except for the EMC issue, I plan to address only the capacity auction issues, market value, and I will try to touch briefly on the depreciation question. A utility must comply with the capacity auction statute in order to use the resulting price in the capacity auction formula. Otherwise, the legislative purpose is frustrated.
But the statute doesn't clearly tie the 15% to the reimbursement, or whatever you call it. And it's hard to think why it should. I mean, it could have been 20%, it could have been 10%. I mean, there's nothing magical about 15%, except that that was what the legislature thought it would take, maybe, to sort of prime the pump with these new startups. Isn't that right?
Your Honor, the language in the statute that connects the two is found in is that the statute requires reconciliation with the price of power obtained through the capacity auctions under Section 39.153. So that's the indication that you have to go back and look at 153. Section 153 has the 15% requirement. And also the PUC
The 15% isn't a requirement. There's a safe harbor, alternate safe harbor. I mean, it seems to me that all the exceptions to it indicate that it's not a requirement.
The statute makes the 15% requirement. What the PUC, what happened?
I'm sorry, counsel. Which statute specific section is referencing 153? Give that cite that you started.
I'm sorry. The true-up statute, 262D, is going to send you back to the capacity auction statute.
Thank you.
39.153. And as to why there's 15%, 15%, as you said, is partly to be sure that there is enough electricity available for sale, but it's also as part of that is it's trying to develop a market to be sure that we have a real market for this. And from that market, we're going to determine the market price to be used in the capacity auction true-up.
And so if that's true, does it matter whether there was 15%? Because they weren't close. I think they were just at 65%, right?
They sold 10% total.
Two-thirds of what they should have, yeah. Right.
Right. Before you even get to the question of the one particular product that they failed to meet the safe harbor on, they only sold 10%.
But there are all these safe harbors, and if they'd met one of those, then it wouldn't have the 15% wouldn't have mattered.
The safe harbors were adopted, and I think it's important to look at the process in which the safe harbors were adopted. First, they were adopted as the process was going along. Before the auctions began, parties were getting concerned about, well, the rule had set forth the four products you needed to sell and how much of each product you needed to sell for each auction. And the parties came and said, we've reached an agreement that if they don't sell everything in one auction, they can propose to sell it at another time so that it'll all get sold, but it doesn't matter which auction it's sold at. That applied to the first two auctions for 2002 electricity. Then for 2003 power, there was an amendment to the rule. And again, you had all the parties able to come in and give input in how this should be done. And the language is that if enough is sold if the required amount is sold in 1 month, it will be deemed to meet the 15%. So we're still tying back to the 15%. It's just that we have created first by a settlement that was adopted by the PUC and later by this rule, these safe harbors. But it really doesn't matter because CenterPoint didn't meet those safe harbors. That's why the commission had to go and come up with some proxy to put in the formula. The formula for the capacity auction, which this court discussed in the CenterPoint opinion, looked at determining whether or not to determine whether or not the utility had recovered the margin that it was expected to recover under the ECOM method, which was a way of saying we want to be sure that the utility recovers what it would have recovered if we had regulated rates. And the way that the formula did that was to say, well, first we'll come up with the margin, the ECOM margin, and then we'll compare that to a number. And in that number, we will take the total amount of electricity sold. It talks about total bus bar for 2002, 2003. But what that means is all the electricity you put on the grid, we'll multiply that by the capacity auction price, and that's because it was assumed that the price from the capacity auction would be most representative of a true market price. But what happened was they didn't sell the required amount. Therefore, the commission looked at coming up with some sort of proxy for that, and because they're looking for what really is the market price. And
was this just a failure of vision when the statute was written? That it looks to me like even in the late 90s, if you were sitting around thinking, what's going to happen in this capacity auction, it would occur to somebody that maybe not all these products would sell.
Obviously, the legislature believed that 15% would sell. In fact, the language of the statute is at least 15%. Should be sold in the capacity auctions. So clearly the legislature intended and expected that this amount would be sold, and that once you sold that amount, you would indeed have a number that could be used for the capacity auction true-up. But because we didn't have that number, because there was a failure of the utility to comply with capacity auction, the commission took evidence from the parties about what to do, and it was suggested by at least one of the witnesses that the most appropriate thing was to look at all their sales. And there was a...
Does the commission think at this point, after hearing all the evidence and going through the process, that the failure to make the sales was CenterPoint's fault or was Genco's fault or... was market conditions, or does it have an explanation for why it ended up the way it did?
The Public Utility Commission did not make any finding about whose fault it was. Whatever reason that it happened, we didn't have the 15% that was necessary. We didn't have the capacity auction price that would be representative of the market. And therefore, as I said, we had testimony that said, well, the best way to come up with the price to put in there is look at what they really sold their electricity at. And to allay concerns about, well, some of that was sold to their affiliated company, you have testimony from CenterPoint's witness, Mr. Tease. He says that it, quote, designed its, and it's describing its private options, it designed its private auction products to the extent permitted by the commission's rules to attract bidders. And the auctions ensured that the related customer, the utility's biggest customer, RRI, was paying a market price for the power it received. So you have some assurance that indeed, even though some of those sales were to the affiliated company, they were done at a market price, that the way they had structured it created a market. And therefore, it was appropriate for the commission to use this price that included all their sales because that accomplishes the legislative purpose, which is to be sure, as this court said in the CenterPoint opinion, that the utility receives no more and no less than the margin predicted by the ECOM method. And that's accomplished by what the commission did, even though we didn't have the capacity auction number to plug into the formula. We had to plug in a different number because you didn't have a capacity auction that complied with the statute and with the rules that were adopted pursuant to the statute.
But if is it true that if they had just sold those 21 units for $5,000, whatever month it was, that we wouldn't be here worrying about this?
I doubt that, Your Honor, for a couple of reasons. For one thing, the commission found that for 2002, the safe harbor that existed was the one from its earlier orders and their findings in the order about that. The testimony that the utility relies upon to say, oh, we came within the safe harbor, is looking at the safe harbor that was adopted in the rule. That rule was adopted in 2002, but because of the way the auctions were set up, all of the 2002 power had already been auctioned before that rule came into effect. So that rule only affected the sales of the 2003 power. So they didn't meet the safe harbor. There isn't a specific finding to that effect, but there's the finding that the safe harbor only applied to two of the 2002 auctions. And looking at the record, it's clear that they didn't meet exactly the amount for the other two auctions in 2002, so you wouldn't even get to the 1 cent. But there are also problems with there are other problems with that 1 cent argument. It was a last minute proposal that was made. In fact, there is mention in briefing of another proceeding. It's Project 27744, and much of one of the orders about that is quoted in testimony in this case. That was something that the utility filed where they came in and said, in essence, they said, well, we didn't sell the 15%, but if you look at our private auctions, we sold at least 15% to people other than our affiliate there, so say it's okay that we didn't sell the 15%. We didn't meet the safe harbors, but how are we possibly going to do that at this point? Because we all know the only sales we have left are winter sales, and we all know that this particular product, gas intermediate, sells best in the summer. And oh, by the way, we can't sell any more for the summer because we've already sold the rest of the summer power through our private capacity auctions.
Ms. Sterling, can we shift gears and talk about market value?
Yes, Your Honor. When this utility failed to comply with the statutory method to determine the market value, the commission had to rely on evidence in the record to determine that amount. CenterPoint failed to comply with the partial stock valuation method, which was the one that it chose. And this is a question of pure statutory interpretation.
Did it get to pick?
Yes, Your Honor.
The statute doesn't seem that clear to me, but the commission's view is that whichever paragraph the utility picks, that's it.
The commission's view is that the utility gets to pick any one of the H methods. If the H methods don't work for a nuclear product, then they go to the I method for the nuclear.
Even if even if the values are very different under the different methods?
It's the utility's choice. The utility, as the utility has pointed out, there's, you know, you might not be able, you may have some trouble doing this. It may be hard to have complied with this method.
Right, but say you did. Say you complied with all four of them and they had very different numbers.
It would be difficult to comply with all four of them.
Say you complied with two. PSV and the sale of the assets.
It was the utility that got to choose, and if they had complied strictly with what they were required to do, the commission would look at that number. Because
would the commission allow them to propose alternative valuations?
We do not have the circumstance to know for sure, but I think it's highly likely that had they come in and said, we told you we were going to, in our business separation plan, that we were going to do a partial stock valuation, but the stock market's not doing that well. We don't think all 19% are going to get sold. We'd like to change our method and go to something else. In this particular case, I would assume that the commission would have allowed them to do that. Now, there are other...
Why would you assume that?
Because we're looking for a valid market value under the statute. And because, for example, some of the times for when we were going to have the true-ups were changed to allow people to comply with the market methods that they were using to be sure that they completed them. As I said, we don't know. There's no finding by the PUC. It's just that it seems that that would be a reasonable thing if they'd come in and said, we're sorry, we just can't do it, but we still have all our assets. We could go to H4, and that's what we've decided to do.
Why is an attempt to sell 19% or put 19% of this on the market a reasonable assumption that they tried to comply?
Because what I was talking about is being able to come back in and completely comply with another one, which they did not do. And I'd like to point out a difference here too between what's going on under the market valuation and the capacity auction. This is different from the capacity auction because with the change from regulation to competition, with so much money at stake and with so many customers potentially avoided, the utility must receive permission. It can't wait to ask for forgiveness. For the capacity auction, people were coming in saying, there's a problem selling some of these products, let's make a change. And the commission first took the settlement and said, okay, we're going to do the settlement. All the parties were involved in that. Everybody had a chance to talk about it, and it was done before the fact. With the capacity, with the safe harbor rule, you had a rulemaking. Everybody came in, everybody got to talk about it and give input, and the commission adopted a rule and said, okay, if you do this much, you'll be deemed to have sold your 15%. Here, the utility went through its whole process. It didn't say ahead of time, oh, we don't think we can really sell 19%. It waited until the true-up and then said, well, close enough is good enough, and it's not, because this is a question of statutory interpretation. And
is there any question in the commission's mind that there was a real transparent market that was establishing price and the New York Stock Exchange shares were trading hands and you could kind of tell what the price was?
There was no question raised that there was anything the matter with what was going to change other than the fact that this did not comply with the language.
Well, then, with that said, part of your brief, you say that a key part of the legislative intent behind that statute is that a sufficiently large share of the company's stock be sold in bona fide market transactions so as to provide a reliable market valuation of the generation assets. Why wouldn't that be enough? You've got stocks being sold, 37.8 or whatever you said, a million transactions. Why wouldn't that establish a market?
Because it was the legislature's choice how much is enough. And the legislature said you have to sell 19%.
Is it possible to know that you did? Is it humanly possible?
I believe it is. There is certainly, there's testimony in this record, which is cited in our brief, that shows that they had records to show, because of some of the institutional owners, that they knew, I am not sure of the exact amount, I believe it's about 16%. They knew for sure that that had been sold because of the way that that's traded, which is why if they sold more, they could have known they had 19%.
But if somebody's got 500 shares and he wants to keep it in his shoebox, there's nothing anybody can do about that.
I would think it's probably possible, but it might be very difficult to do it. However, it was the legislature's call that you needed to sell 19%.
Well, but called for too much speculation. If you put 51%, you're going to lose your company. If you put something less than that, you may or may not sell 19%. I mean, how do you know? I mean, why not start off with the 19% and see what happens and then come back to you like they did? I mean, that seems to make complete business sense to me.
Well, as I started to say, I think there is there's an element of risk on any of these. When we were moving from regulated to competitive rates, and the legislature chose that we wanted markets to determine the market value of these assets. Well, when you've got markets involved, there's always a certain amount of risk. They might have tried to sell their assets and not found a buyer.
As often happens in these type of deals.
So there was a risk any way they did it. The legislature said, you know, these are sophisticated, large companies. They're going to figure out how to do it, whether it's a matter of selling all the assets or selling 19% of the stock or 51% of the stock. That's part of why they have the option to figure out which method they want to use.
So is it your view, kind of boiled down, that the valuation methodologies in the statute are binding on the utility, but maybe not necessarily binding on the commission?
That once there is no valuation method that's complied by the utility, that then the commission has authority to figure out what to do to come
you
up with
one. You say it's just implied, just sort of...
Yes, it is implied. I beg your pardon?
That if they kind of fall short on their chosen valuation method, the commission can then sort of ad lib and sort of devise an alternative methodology that's not prescribed in the statute, but that you think kind of gets to the heart of it.
Trying to come as close as possible. In fact, when the PUC came up with this, it tried to figure out what the utility would have sold the stock at had it followed the partial stock valuation method that it chose.
Well, counsel, do you have any reason not to believe that a sale of 15.2 million or a distribution of 15.2 million shares to 55,000 stockholders on the New York Stock Exchange, where those shares traded for 14 months, does not give you a reasonable market value for the shares? Can you say that it does not?
Well, Your Honor, the question, once they didn't comply with the statute,
well,
was to look at all...
Let me get you to answer my question, and then you can change the question.
I'm sorry. Could you ask it again? I'm afraid I didn't.
Does the process by which the shares were traded on the New York Stock Exchange and the number of shares involved, the number of shareholders involved over 14 months, give you any basis to say that the valuation from those transactions is not a reasonable market value?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, there would have been a necessary to apply the control panel to it. The control premium, because the statute said if you sell the 19%, we have to apply the control premium. And you'll remember that the control panel came back and reported a large amount of difference. The statute, had they followed the statute, you would have a limited amount you would stop at. They didn't follow the statute. So if you're just looking at the factual evidence and not, you know, you have failed to comply with the statutory method, you're looking at the evidence in the record, then it would seem that it would be very reasonable from the record to say, well, it's the share price adjusted as much as it would have been adjusted under the control panel to come up with what the fair value is. But the commission looked at all of the evidence in the record and decided that this was the best way to come to meet what was designed by the legislature for how much the market value should be.
Why did you think that when there was a pending contract sale of the assets?
There are several problems with the pending contract. First of all, it happened too late. There was a contract, but there wasn't a sale, and the statute talks about the assets shall be sold. The nuclear assets...
Sold by when?
Sold before you're doing the true-up. And the nuclear assets under this contract were not sold until April. The order on rehearing in this case was in December.
It seems kind of technical.
Well, as
has when you've been, got a binding contract and say, oops, it's not closed yet.
As was pointed out earlier, there were regulatory approvals that had to be received, and you don't know whether they're going to be received or not. So, and we know that the nuclear assets are the largest amount of what causes stranded costs. In addition to that, it's not the method chosen by the utility, and the utility is the one...
Well, they didn't choose yours either. That's the problem.
This was
that's
trying...
That's why we're here, is that they don't like yours either.
Well, yes, what we do have here is the commission didn't take the failed partial stock valuation that the company did, which would have given the largest amount of stranded costs, nor did the commission take the contract, which had not been accomplished yet, which would have given the lowest amount of stranded costs under this record. Instead, the commission looked at everything and said, based on all the evidence we've got in the record, the best value that we can come up with is this one that's kind of in the middle, that happens to be the same that the control panel came up with, that's the best number based on this record for market value that we can use.
Do you know how long after the true-up proceeding was the sale finalized?
In April, and the true-up proceeding, as I said, the order on rehearing was in December.
But the sale was finalized, as your co-counsel said, at the exact price set forth in the agreement?
I don't personally know that for sure, but I have every reason to trust that counsel who told you that is telling you the truth on that. I'd like to go back also just briefly to the language of the statute and why the commission said you have to sell 19%. When you look at the language of the statute, the way the utility does, you have to turn much of the wording of the statute into surplusage. If you want to look at it, it's under tab 15 of the handout that the utility gave you. The wording here has a subject and a pair of verbs, and the subject is at least 19%, but less than 51%, and it has to be spun off and sold. And what the utility tries to do is to divorce the subject from the verb, from the second verb, sold. They said, oh, you're right, we have to spin off 19%, but less than 51%. But that doesn't apply with the second verb there, and sold. And you can't pull the statute that way.
The trouble I have with the argument, though, is that it sounds kind of like a bizarre game of hopscotch, that because they didn't meet this very technical interpretation of paragraph 3, we get to make up something that's not in the statute, top side or bottom. Now, why would you strain over an interpretation of the statutory language and then go totally outside the statute to come up with the bottom line answer?
Well, Your Honor, with respect, we don't think that the commission was straining to come up with this. This was the plain language the legislature had adopted. It says 19%, but less than 51% has to be sold. Doesn't say listed, doesn't say offered. And furthermore, if you think about it, to say that it has to be listed creates another problem with the statute. Because when you list stock, you don't just list a portion of your stock, you list the whole issue. All the common stock had to be listed. They were sure it wasn't going to be sold because they were holding on to 80% of it. But all of the stock is listed, so if listing it is enough, then when they listed it, they violated it the other way because they sold more than 51% if it's just listing. The statutory language requires that 19%, at least 19%, and less than 51% be spun off and sold. And this transaction did not comply with that. We may come up with ways that we think it would have been more reasonable for the legislature to have drafted this, but we don't draft the legislation. The court doesn't draft the legislation. We have to deal with the language of the statute, and it requires that that subject, at least 19%, but less than 51%, attached to both of the verbs, spun off and sold.
The problem I have, you say you have to come up with a reasonable way, you read the statutes where it doesn't apply, and then when none of the statute applies, you go totally outside, the commission goes totally outside the statute to come up with its own evaluation method. I don't understand why that makes sense.
It makes sense because the statute clearly required, there is no dispute that utilities were supposed to recover stranded costs. If you go all the way back to the first section of this, stranded costs are supposed to be recovered. In order to recover stranded costs, you need two numbers, net value and market value. We didn't have a market value that complied with the statute. The commission had to do something. And it looked at the statutory language about what can it do. And we have the requirement in 39262 C and G that says the commission is supposed to finalize stranded costs, the commission is supposed to adjust the non-bypassable fees to collect them, so you've got authority, they're supposed to come up with a number. And then when you look at the definition, 39251(4), it says market value means the value the assets would have if bought and sold in a bona fide third-party transaction or transactions on the open market under 39262H. So the commission says, okay, we don't have one that does comply. We've got a big record here. We can look at the evidence and try to figure out what it would have sold at if it had been done in compliance with the statute.
There's an argument that if there's a question about the applicability of one, the case should be returned to the commission. Do you have a position on that?
I'm sorry, the applicability of one?
Sale of assets.
If there are changes, if this needs to be changed, then yes, this case has to be sent back to the commission to decide how to change it.
But you don't want it again.
I'm sure we want it again as much as the court wants it again. Obviously, if changes are made, it has to go back because you can't just affect one piece of the order. For example, if stranded costs change, interest change, it changes a lot of other numbers. If changes need to be made, it needs to go back to the commission. And in fact, under the Court of Appeals order, it goes back to the commission. And I see my time is up.
Are there any further questions? Thank you. Court is ready to hear a rebuttal. Mr. Coleman.
I know there are things you want to respond to, but somewhere along the line, could you please respond to Mr. Hall's argument that the burden of all this is being passed on to consumers, and specifically low-income consumers or customers?
Yes, Justice Medina. Let me start with the EMCs, and then I'll come back to some of the other points I'd like to make. What gets lost in this entire argument about whether we should get reimbursement for the EMCs that were paid to the affiliated rep is that the reason for the EMCs in the first place was to require us to mitigate or to reverse the mitigation that we had already done because the PUC wrongly believed that we would not have stranded costs. It ordered us to pay those amounts to Reliant. When we did, the purpose of doing that was to reverse mitigation. It was to increase our stranded costs. And every dollar of EMCs that we paid increased our stranded costs by $1. $1 is $1. Nobody said, oh, by the way, the money you're paying to Reliant, we just want you to pay that. We don't want that to increase your stranded costs. when that was made, those reversals were made on an accounting basis. No matter who we paid them to, $1 of EMCs is $1 of stranded costs. The statute says that we are entitled to recover our stranded costs. Mr. Hall made the comment that we should not recover again from the same customers. And I want to make clear that that is not an accurate description of how these payments are to be made. The EMCs were sent out to all of the retailers, and when they are recovered, they're recovered from all of the retailers. So this $385 million that we're talking about, it's not being recovered solely. It's about money that went to Reliant, but it's not being recovered solely from Reliant customers. These are non-bypassable charges that go across the entire customer base. It's not former Reliant customers who by now have scattered to the winds with a variety of different retailers. It goes across the entire customer base. There's no sense of unfairness or impropriety that's directed towards people who were Reliant customers at the time. This is a red herring, all right? We were ordered to pay these. They increased our stranded costs. We're entitled to receive our stranded costs dollar for dollar. That is the statutory mandate, and there is no justification at all for saying we're just not going to give you back part of that because we have this after-the-fact distinction that nobody made and nobody thought of and would have been laughed at if they had thought of it when we were ordered to pay the EMCs in the first place.
I'd like to turn back to some
of the other arguments. And with respect to the partial stock valuation and ultimately with capacity auction, there's a fundamental issue that I think is not being accurately represented here. 10 and a half years ago, when the legislature finally decided that we are going to enact this deregulation, these statutes were put in place not as a lark, but as a blueprint for a very complicated unbundling of an age-old industry that had been heavily regulated and was now being moved to a deregulated industry. These companies were being forced to break themselves apart, and they had to have a plan for doing that. And so with respect to the capacity auctions and the partial stock valuation, this market valuation that had to take place, we needed the ability to plan, and we did that. We had a business separation plan. We had a series of hearings in which this was approved. From the second amended business plan, here is how we are going to do this. That was approved, and we went forward and did it. And the position that the PUC now takes is that notwithstanding the years and years of planning and the millions and millions of dollars that went into this, at the end of the day, Too bad, so sad. It's not based on anything you did. It's based on something that some third party did. So whether it's an IPO or a spinoff, for instance, if unbeknownst to all of us, Justice Wainwright had thousands of shares of stock and decided that he would keep them, we would be denied that recovery under the PUC's interpretation. I mean, if you think about it, if you have two identical companies who are unbundling using the same process, going through every step the same, spinning off all the same stock, one of those companies happens to spin off the stock to shareholders who all of them rush to the market and sell it on the market, and the other company has, one or two shareholders who hold on to 0.5% or 1%, one of those companies is denied the recovery under the PUC's interpretation, and the other one isn't.
But don't you account for that by maybe going to a 40% spinoff? Does that matter?
It doesn't really matter at the end of the day. While it is possible that it's more likely, it is also certainly possible if you did a 40% IPO and some raider rushed off to the underwriter and said, I want 22% of that company, you wouldn't know that, and then you would be denied. There's no way to be sure that these years and years of planning are going to be given effect. And there is a textual basis for our argument. We're not relying solely on the fact that there is nothing there. spun off and sold, the PUC wants to just treat those words as a slurred word, spun off and sold. Okay? That's not the way to read it. It's spun off and sold to public investors through a national stock exchange. The through a national stock exchange does not textually suggest that all 19% are individually sold, and you can't spin off to investors through a national stock exchange. There is some textual separation of those terms that give it a natural reading that you need to spin off, and that then the shares are sold or to public investors through a national stock exchange. The word through does suggest the natural process of having them being listed and being active. And the PUC acknowledges that it's a fair market price.
Under that reading, what's the purpose of the 19% and not some other number?
The 19%, 20% is the cutoff for being able to file a consolidated tax return. And so there was some movement there to pick a number that was lower that would allow you to have a consolidated tax return, but close to that number. That was the number that was used, that was the number we planned for, and that was the number that we put into effect over a very long period of time, only to be told that at the end of the day, based on the actions of third parties, we're reinterpreting the statute now, and we're going to deny you this recovery and give you a number that is more of a feel-good number for us that we think is more fair. Which brings me again now to the capacity auction.
Quick question, even if we agree about the textual separation in that phrase, the 19% applies to each part, to the sold off, the spun off and sold?
The 19% was available to be sold. And so any market is based not only on people who sell, but people who hold, because the price is ultimately decided not merely on supply, but also on demand. You have to have both. You have to have people who are saying, I'm not willing to sell at that price. Now, if somebody comes and offers $1,000 a share, more people will sell. But the market is decided based on both supply and demand, and not only on one of them. With respect to the capacity auction true-up, you have the same problem. All right. Again, we've had this comment made about what is the textual connection? There is a reference back to the sales in 153, but it doesn't say conditioned on satisfaction or anything. It just says it identifies the sales that are to be used to calculate the true-up. You calculate the true-up based on the sales under 153. That's what the PUC should have done. There is no basis to say we're going to use other sales, even their own rule, the formula that they put in place based on the statute, doesn't allow them to do that. And to have the PUC stand up today and say, well, we didn't like the results. We thought that their sales and their private auctions in the private market represented a market price, and so it was reasonable for us to do that. If you ignore the statute and the rule, maybe there's some reason to it, but if the legislature has said use these sales and these sales only, it's not, as a matter of law, it's not reasonable to say we are going to use other sales as well. There's no justification for doing that. And again, the finger seems to be pointing at CenterPoint saying, well, we failed to sell the 15%. We sold everything that people wanted to purchase.
What if you would have sold only 5% or 10% or some number significantly lower? What would have been?
Well, I think the argument, Justice Medina, is that we did sell 10%, but it's, again, undisputed. We sold everything that those new reps wanted to purchase. So we provided that market. It was a fair, transparent market. And as Justice Hecht pointed out, could you come in and buy? Well, maybe not, but TXU could have come in and purchased that at a low bid rate. It wouldn't have affected, if we had bid at TXU's auctions and you had bid at ours, it wouldn't have affected the capacity auction true-up at the end. It simply would have said, we're doing the 15% just to do the 15%, and it doesn't achieve the legislative objective of making sure that the capacity is available for these new entities.
See that your time has expired. Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Coleman.
May it please the court. I want to address the market value issue first. And I want to refer back to the Centerpoint opinion of this court, in which the court began with the proposition that the statute was designed to assure that utilities would recover their stranded costs. The statute also says that they're not entitled to over-recover their stranded costs. And what Mr. McClanahan said was, we want our book value. That's the controlling purpose of this statute, is to assure that they get their total book value. What has happened here is this utility is urging through its assertion that the partial stock valuation methodology was successfully employed. They want $511 million more than they actually got in the sale. The sale that was simultaneously with the true-up proceeding. They want more than their stranded cost. They want more than their book value. That's what they are urging this court. So let's start with what's the objective of the statute. The statute says you get your stranded cost, you get your net book value. That's what Mr. McClanahan said. So how do we work with this? Our view is that the legislature may have improvidently designed the partial stock valuation methodology. It may be difficult to apply and make workable. The commission determined that it had not been complied with. It's clearly supported by substantial evidence. But taking Justice Heck's proposition, well, let's assume for a moment that there were two methodologies that were complied with. One was the fair market transaction, and one was the partial stock valuation methodology. The commission, under those circumstances, under the statute, is required to select the choice that assures that there is no over-recovery of stranded cost, and that they get only their net book value. That's the whole purpose of this stranded cost exercise, is to put the utilities where they get the full value of their assets. Now let's talk for
Council,
a moment. Excuse me.
Let me ask you about the valuation methods and structure of that statute. I'm not entirely clear about the state's position on this. If none of the five valuation methods were complied with, what would PUC do then?
Well, our position is, this, I think, directly was raised in an earlier question. Our position is that when all methodologies fail, the Act nevertheless contemplates the use of real market transactions. The Commission went outside and said, we're going to use discounted cash flow and various data points, and we're going to come up with an estimate. That's not what the Commission should have done. The question in this case is, when the utilities methodology fails, then isn't the commission constrained to select a methodology which is provided for in the statute and which meets the objective of the legislature to use real market transactions? The legislature understood that when you start using expert testimony to evaluate anything, you just invite a bunch of controversy about who's right. The way to settle that is to have an actual market transaction, and that's what the commission should have adopted in this case.
So would you view as inappropriate if the failure on partial stock valuation method was that it didn't comply with the 19%, wasn't proven to comply with that? As I understand it, your argument is CenterPoint didn't carry its burden to prove 19%, but we don't know it wasn't 19%, just CenterPoint didn't carry its
burden.
That's
correct.
So if CenterPoint failed to carry that obligation to prove up that approach under the statute, you're saying that the PUC should look at actual market valuations. Couldn't the PUC then go back and say, well, 16% is pretty good valuation of 15 million shares over 14 months. We're going to use that since there was a failure to comply with any of the five methods.
There was not a failure to comply. There was one that was complied with. We have a real market deal. There was a sale.
She says that it happened too late.
Your Honor, the cases say to have a sale, you don't have to have a closing where the title of the stock certificates passes. You've got all the terms and conditions. Why would you not accept a sale where the terms and conditions have been written down in a 100-page document and say, it didn't close. Part of it didn't close until after the commission.
Counsel, have you ever had a transaction where it was written up in a 100-page document with the closing 4 weeks later and the dollars changed?
I have, but here's the point. When you have a choice between data points and discounted cash flow methodologies, and you've got a sale where parties have had a meeting of the minds and written it down, this is the better indication of a real market transaction. And you ought to pick that, because that is what in this case, the company has never said that we haven't gotten our full book value. What they're arguing here is we want more. We didn't get enough.
If we agree with you that arm's length, real actual transaction is the better barometer, what should we do?
What you ought to do is to tell the commission that they are constrained when the methodology selected by the company has failed to select a methodology that qualifies as a real market transaction under the statute. That should be their preference, and remand it back to them for further consideration. They rejected this. If you read that, a very superficial, conclusive finding of fact. They didn't like the date, and they said, well, we don't think it's closed yet. When the cases say clearly, you can treat it as a sale when there has been an agreement on all the terms and conditions.
Was there a deadline on completing the TRIO?
No. I mean, they filed, and certainly the commission had constraints about proceeding to get this case resolved. But there,
they could have left it open another couple of months.
Absolutely. Now let me talk for a moment about the capacity auction true-up. I listened carefully to Mr. Coleman's closing, and there's some important points. The statute says that 15% is a requirement. It says you shall sell it. It's mandatory. Language is mandatory. The commission adopted a safe harbor rule that established a very low boundary for substantial compliance. They didn't meet that. It's uncontested. They didn't meet it. How close did they get? They didn't do it in 2002. That's not material. The commission defined substantial compliance. They didn't meet it. So what do you do? We're not here arguing they shouldn't get any capacity auction true-up. That's not the purpose of the statute. The fundamental objective of the statute was they should get the margins that they were supposed to get under the ECOM model for the time period. Not once has the company stood up today and said, we didn't get our margins. No, what they're saying is, give us the formula because it's an over-recovery, and we know it is, and we want it. We want $440 million more. They don't say the fundamental objective has not been accomplished. They have to admit they got their margins. They got what this court said the purpose of the capacity auction true-up was. They've gotten the full compliance. The way to look at this case is, what were the overriding objectives of the legislature? Look, this statute is messy in a lot of different ways, and I know the court appreciates that. And it's a very complicated area. The legislature was in many ways poking around in the dark. No one had ever done this before. But the way to look at it is to take the first principles. The last principle is this. There is no question that the statute says that the joint applicants are to be treated together and that their recovery is to be regarded as a unit, that's a matter of plain statutory meaning. When these EMCs were paid, as Mr. Hall indicated, the money was taken from one pocket and put in another. And that's all that happened. And what they're, Justice Heck's question is exactly right. Well, who bears the burden for, yeah, these were excess earnings, yes. Ratepayers had already paid excess earnings. Now they say, well, we want it again. Why? Because they adopted a structure of business separation and then failed to anticipate this problem, apparently. I don't know whether there's any cause of action between CenterPoint and Reliant at this point. I'm not sure. But the point is, it was their burden. Why should ratepayers pay twice? And that's all that is at issue here, because under the statute, they are a unit. They are to be regarded as a unit, and the Court of Appeals got that dead right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, all counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.